Dorothy Parker's Constant Reader, a column in the New Yorker. Wallflower's Lament, November 17, 1928. It has lately been drawn to your correspondent's attention that, at social gatherings, she is not the human magnet she would be. Indeed, it turns out that as a source of entertainment, conviviality, and good fun, she ranks somewhere between a sprig of parsley and a single ice skate. It would appear from the actions of the assembled guests that she is about as hot company as a night nurse. I don't mean that these facts have been pointed out to her in so many words. Not yet. Although there is a fair chance that a certain young gentleman of her acquaintance, who gets the Frankies after the fourth Anis Deloso and goes around telling people what makes them so terrible, will shortly be sitting by her side and beginning, "Look, you know what's the matter with you?" Thus far, she has drawn her deductions from the fact that the invitations have been dying off like flies, so that most of her evenings are given to powdering her friends' backs or straightening their ties, as the case may be, saying, "Now have a good time, and be sure to tell me who was there," waving bye-bye smilingly, and then settling down for a hearty attack of the left all alone again yips. On such occasions as she does make those parties where the hosts apparently assemble the list of guests by drawing names out of a hat, she sits in a corner with her thoughts, smiling brightly all the while, in order to indicate a pathetic willingness to play, or else she listens to something that used to be in the SOS explain, with the aid of a paper and a gold pencil, the course of the war from April 7, 1917, until late afternoon of Armistice Day. So, being one who can take a hint after the first 30 repetitions, she is now conceding her flop, and retiring constructively from society. Do you know anyone who would want a comparatively young woman, young as compared to the Grand Canyon, for instance, fairly free and looks white under electric light, to sit up with the children evenings and let the nurse go out? It's not that she has not tried to improve her condition before acknowledging its hopelessness. Oh, come on, let's get the hell out of this and get into the first person. I have sought, by study, to better my form and make myself society's darling. You see, I have been fed in my youth a lot of old wives' tales about the way men would instantly forsake a beautiful woman to flock to a brilliant one. But it is fair to say that, after getting out into the world, I'd never seen this happen. But I thought that maybe I might be the girl to start the vogue. I would become brilliant. I would sparkle. I would hold whole dinner tables spellbound. I'd have throngs fighting to come within hearing distance of me while the weakest, elbowed mercilessly to the outskirts, would cry, "What did you say?" or, "Oh, please ask her to tell it again." That's what I would do. Oh, I could just hear myself. So I got a book called Favorite Jokes of Famous People, and settled down to read it, memorize its gems, and repeat them at select gatherings. And from the time of the world premiere of my recital until this very living moment, I haven't had an evening off my hands. It was doubtless ill-advised for me, a very tyro, at least a pretty tyro, as a raconteuse, to start off with the selection given in the book as the favorite of Mr. Bruce Barton, a selection which, by the way, could scarcely be classified as the joke nobody knows. Thus does Mr. Barton begin his chosen story. In the pre-Prohibition days, two young men set forth one evening from Detroit in an automobile. Awakening the next morning, after a somewhat tempestuous night, they found themselves parked in front of a large building which they assumed to be a hotel, but was in fact a sanitarium. The proprietor of the institution was not only a vegetarian, but a zealous member of a religious order. Whew, that, you will admit, is a rough start for the amateur storyteller. You have to remember practically everything except your stance. Pre-Prohibition, Detroit, two young men, automobile, next morning, hotel which wasn't a hotel, proprietor who's not only a vegetarian, but a member of a religious order. Oh, that's advanced stuff. It's perhaps sufficient to say I made a fool of the anecdote. I represented the two young men as coming from Fort Wayne. Since then, I've had no heart for favorite jokes of famous people. I can't even do much about reading it in moments of leisure. The book has been compiled by Mr. Frank Nicholson, who dedicates it to a famous man whose favorite joke is not included in this collection. He did not choose to pun. So you can see that he is just the boy who was cut out to collect the best humor. Mr. Nicholson adds his own touches in giving brief biographies of each celebrity who's represented. One recalls, perhaps most sharply, his dainty line in his Jean Tunney piece. "Jean says if he gets married, he'll quit fighting. What an optimist that guy is!" Which is my entrant for the 1928 Pulitzer Prize for doing most to advance American manners and standards of culture. It is to be guessed, too, that Mr. Nicholson does not confine his authoring to the biographies. Here and there it seems as he must have crashed into the jokes themselves. For example, in Donald Ogden Stewart's favorite story, The Magnificent Epic of the Horse That Sat on Eggs, Mr. Nicholson has Mr. Stewart referring to that blankety-blank horse. It has been my privilege to have known Mr. Stewart since he wore sailor suits. He was in the Navy during the war. And never yet have I heard him use any such expression as blankety-blank, or at least certainly not in the presence of any woman. Out of favorite jokes of famous people comes one ray of light, one breath of strange new fragrance, one cool and silver star. That is the selection given by Mr. Ring Lardner. It's too frail, too exquisite to reproduce here, though I can scarcely tear myself away from quoting it, and it is a source of perpetual amazement that Mr. Frank Ernest Nicholson, author of What an Optimist That Guy Is, could have admitted this white violet to his collection. Probably he figured out some meaning to the masterpiece and will never, never realize that it was Mr. Lardner at his sublime best in the act of kidding the living tripe out of all such collections of famous things of famous whosits. Well, to get back to me as quickly as possible, when our heroine found out that she was the bust of the season as a wit and elocutionist, she decided to turn to that good old standby, sex. Let others raconteur if they will, I said, but gangway while I go garbo. To that end, I acquired a book called The Technique of the Love Affair by one who signs herself a gentlewoman, and set out to learn how to loop the usual dancing then. I have thought in times past that I had been depressed. I have regarded myself as one who walked hand in hand with sadness, but until I read that book, depression as I knew it was still in its infancy. I have found out from its pages that never once have I been right. Never once. Not even one little time. You know how you ought to be with men? You should always be aloof. You should never let them know you like them. You must on no account let them feel that they are of any importance to you. You must be wrapped up in your own concerns. You may never let them lose sight of the fact that you are superior. You must be, in short, a regular stuffed chemise. And if you could see what I've been doing. Despite its abominable style and its frequent sandy stretches, the technique of the love affair makes, I'm bitterly afraid, considerable sense. If only it had been written and placed in my hands years ago, maybe I could have been successful instead of just successive.